The Psychedologist.
Hello, everyone. Another episode coming to you from Costa Rica. So please forgive me in advance for the noise of rain and insects and just overall interference that is inescapable in Costa Rica. All the same, we are very, very blessed and privileged and lucky to be here during this time in history. So this episode is with Marisa Sturtz. She speaks about her consciousness journey, rebelling against her born-again Christian background, and finding revelation and answers through psychedelics at the age of 19. She discusses what followed, including Gaia TV series The Healing Powers, Lucid News, and the Psychedelic Orientation series, film projects and journeys that brought her around the world, meeting God on a psilocybin journey, and her mission henceforth, including but not limited to bringing the Sphinx Gate to Burning Man post-COVID-19. Marisa is a filmmaker, community organizer, and certified Kundalini yoga teacher. She is a co-founder and the media director of Lucid News, a platform providing informed, honest, and transparent journalism that covers the growing integration of psychedelics into society and their broad implications for human wellness. Marisa is passionate about finding solutions to systemic problems, and her work is heavily informed by her own journey of healing, which has taken her all around the world, filming with the curanderos of Peru to the holy men of India. She has a BA in cinema at San Francisco State University, and her documentaries have been featured by Gaia TV, Viceland, Indigenous Films, Mary Jane, and Participant. She is currently in development of a one-woman play that celebrates the healing journey. Take two of the podcast with Marisa Sturtz. Here we go.
Woohoo!
We are two of the very fortunate and privileged people to be in Costa Rica waiting out the pandemic. And we started doing a conversation over Skype. The internet cut us off, and so now we're together in person to do it.
Which is way better anyway.
Yes, much better, from a social distance, of course. So I'm excited to have you on the show. We met a few years ago, and you've done a lot of exciting stuff since then, and before then. Can you talk a little bit about your background?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Las Vegas to immigrants from Germany and Austria, who had moved to the States in the mid-70s, and I should probably get closer now because it's raining. Can you still hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Talk to me about your relationship to consciousness as a child.
Whoa. Okay. Cool. Wow, that's an interesting one. That's a really interesting question. Okay. I was raised super religious in Las Vegas. I was raised born-again Christian, and I don't even know if consciousness was a thing for a while, but I think Wow. I mean, it's just like, when did I first start thinking of my own awareness, right? That's like what the question is.
Or not, you know, the relationship to consciousness could be that there was an absence of consciousness about yourself.
Yeah, you know, but I had a lot of angst in my childhood, and, like, there was some trauma, and it was pretty intense, and I just felt unsafe a lot, and, like, afraid that I wasn't doing things right, and it was really intense. And so I think maybe I had a very early relationship to my own awareness because I wanted to do things right, and I was raised super religious. So this question of, well, the idea with born again Christianity was we're all sinners and we're all going to hell unless you accept Jesus Christ into your heart as your eternal begotten savior, something like that. And I was constantly feeling like I was doing things wrong, and there was a lot of punishment in my childhood. And in school we would do detention where we just had to stare at a wall. We had to sit at a desk and have these like white dividers on both sides and a white wall in front of you, and you just had to sit there with your hands folded and stare at the wall for like an hour. you know, and then like little kids, right? You know, I was like 8 or 9 and I got detention for whatever, kicking my feet under the chair or something. And, you know, so there was a lot of self-inquiry around how to do things right. And I think that was the beginning of a lot of neuroses and like super neurotic thought patterns that I tortured myself with for many, many, many years. But I guess, you know, really the formulations of it were me praying to God and trying to interface with that and understand and feel connected. I feel like, and feel connected and feel at ease. And I just was like super awkward and not at ease most of my childhood. So that was my first interactions with consciousness. Was me trying to make sense of myself so that I could finally feel at ease and not be wrong. Wow. That's a great question. What an interesting way to articulate the strife of childhood and also the self-formulation of self. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So at some point you dropped into a new belief system. What happened there?
At some point I put God on the spot. I mean, I had a handful of things happen. I had family in all my grandparents, all my relatives lived in Europe. So I went away one summer for 3 months. And when I came back, my private Christian school had shut down. And I was, I think, maybe 10 or 11. And at that point, not only had my mind shifted into speaking German so much that when I came home, I forgot how to speak English. Like, I was really weird and awkward with it. But I was also a month late to the public school system. So all the other kids had already started school. I had to jump in, and half of my curriculum before was on Bible verses, so I was super behind. So suddenly I was thrown into public school system in the 4th grade, a month late, and speaking a different language, and it was just one of the biggest culture shocks ever. Kids cursed, they said my name wrong. I was Marissa, which makes, to this day still makes me nuts. And I was Marissa for like 15 years after that, until I really like forced everybody to change how to say it and say it right again. And I don't know, somewhere being in public school system and understanding the world was different than what I had been taught. I don't remember a lot except that I was so behind. It was very hard and rough. But I think that's where my social anxiety and angst really started kicking in. And we would spend so much time still over the weekend in worship and everybody praying. People were going into fits of tongues and hallelujah falling over. A lot of songs with their arms in the sky sort of thing. And I remember praying to God and just being like, okay, you know, I'm praying and wanting to feel a sense of God's presence or just feel that any of this made sense. You know, they were showing us movies about the end of times. They were telling us we were all sinners. We were all wrong unless we accept Jesus Christ in our heart. But when I would accept him in my heart, which I'd been doing as long as I was a young kid, I didn't feel any better. I didn't feel any different. I still always felt wrong. Mm. And so I think it was my constant sense of always feeling wrong with everything that I did that made me feel like my praying wasn't working. Mm. And so I started putting God on the spot and being like, all right, God, if you're really there, like, I want a message. I want to, like, feel your presence and I want to feel something. Give me goosebumps. Because if everyone around me is in fits of tongues and I'm sitting here just feeling wrong about everything, like, something's not fitting. And so after like maybe a year of asking God to give me a sign in church on Sunday mornings and, you know, praying for the whole service or as much as I could, mind you, I'd gotten a trophy that gave me Miss Christian Character the year before, right?
But Miss Christian Character?
Miss Christian Character. I was that exemplary in my like Christian-like behavior of being such a little Miss Goody two-shoes and memorizing Bible verses and whatever. And so I at some point I just, you know, and I also would get into arguments with the pastors and be like, all right, God, so if you're a soldier and you go to war to protect your country and you kill somebody and, you know, that's one of the Ten Commandments, are you going to hell? I mean, and you ask for forgiveness, but then you do it again. Like, how many times do you ask for forgiveness? And like, if you steal to feed your family, are you going to hell? That's committing, you know, the Ten Commandments. And he was like, fucking answers I was getting was like, just have faith, my child. And I was like, this doesn't cut it. Your faith argument here, this is a bunch of bullshit. And after praying for a year, not getting any response, I was like, I give up. This is nothing. This doesn't work. And so I started getting out of church by volunteering to work in the nursery, and I would take care of the kids while my parents, or really my mom, would go to service. My dad was already like kind of getting out of it because he was working in the casinos late at night and had to work late and was like, yeah.
This was in Vegas, right?
This was all in Las Vegas. Oh. My mom was a cocktail waitress at Caesar's Palace, you know, and then we'd like go to the buffet afterwards that were comped, you know, and totally like connections, you know, and it's like so funny. Yeah, it was a very, lots of like paradoxes in my life, even then. So, yeah. And your question was, when did everything shift? And after that, then I just was without a pillar of knowing what to believe in. And I really found myself like grasping and wanting to have a system that made sense of the world and wanting to believe in some order and some harmony and not knowing what it was. And it wasn't until I took LSD at like 19 years old where I first had like a mystical experience and the understanding that we're all one and we're all connected. Again, in response to incredible internal angst and disconnection with others.
In response to what else?
Yeah, right? And then I broke through and I was like, oh wait, we're all one and we're all connected. But it was so cool because I had no introduction to world mysticism. I had no idea about Buddhism or Hinduism at that point. And so I came to that just through some gel caps of LSD in the Las Vegas desert at a rave where I didn't have any real friends. Wow. And I had curled up in a ball by myself, rocking myself in my angst. And then it just broke through. So then I was like, well, there's something to psychedelics here. Holy shit. And it took me like 20 years after, 15 years after that to start really going anywhere of real value. But yeah.
And now you're a filmmaker, a Kundalini yoga teacher, a founder of Lucid News, which is doing some great work, and involved in a lot of different things. You're definitely a leader in the space, I would say.
Thank you. I talk a lot. I make some noise. yeah, so wait, what's my question?
What's been exciting for you lately? Now you're here, and you know what? In what way are you engaging with your consciousness now or with the collective consciousness?
That's juicy. Great connection there. I have been in a process of self-inquiry for pretty seriously for the last like 4 or 5 years. Well, let's just say I've actually been in a serious process of self-inquiry forever, but I finally managed to muster up enough resources to actually really pursue it and like went to the jungles of Peru and worked with shamans there and became certified to be a Kundalini teacher. And basically over the last 5 years worked really diligently and pretty dedicatedly to figuring out what all this strife is about and how to find balance and harmony in my own life and joy and the ability to help take care of others and just abundance. So after being on this path for a bit here in the last like 6 months, I've been in Costa Rica and have started to feel like I kind of have come to the end of this chapter, which feels really, I'm getting close to the end of this chapter. I'm just feeling so grateful and starting to really learn like and understand the bigger scope of what's been happening and why I was so out of balance and what the programs were from my childhood that I was too completely entrenched in to be able to see. But I've been able to like pull away now and unwind them. And in the last month, I've been living in this cute little house that we're at right now. That's like got some pretty awesome jungle backyard or front yard and, been learning what it is to really take care of myself and move in my own life with, by being motivated not from fear and scarcity or things that I have to do, but rather going, what do I want to do right now? What brings me joy? What am I actually compelled to do from a place of like wanting and not from aversion? Because everything prior to was created from aversion and avoiding and scarcity, and I have to. So that's really dialing in right now And I almost feel like the icing on the cake for this is that I get to go do a vision quest and a 4-day fast, wilderness fast, with a couple days on both ends to aid in the integration and the preparation for it. So I'm really excited to do that in a week and a half. I've never done a proper fast. I've done like a juice fast in the past.
Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if there's anything else I want to say on that. I think, yeah. So basically, your other part of your question was, what am I doing? So that's what I'm doing with my own consciousness is kind of finding how to be resourced and live in abundance and enjoy, because from that place I can help so much more. I've been spending a lot of time trying to create content to help people on their own healing journey, but I was still in my own journeys, like coming from so much scarcity and abundance. I was like, I've made a documentary series. It's on Gaia TV and I'm very proud of it, but I made it by the skin of my teeth with no resources and was just killing myself doing all the jobs except for cameraman and except for editing. Which actually I did at some points too, but I was producing, writing, overseeing, hosting, writing the edit and then polishing it all off, which, these are things that normally take teams of like lots of people to pull off. And it was me and the cameraman and an editor.
And you're talking about the healing powers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, it's just like, I have felt that it is my work to help others along the path. I like to provide some of the support that I wish I had had during my journey. So much of my own journey was trying to figure everything out in my mind using, the systems that I've been taught. Like, we evaluate the world through quantifying, calculating, evaluating based on, quantifiable results. And so everything I was doing was always navigated through my mind. All the choices I was making in my life were through the mind. And what this work has taught me is that our bodies are storing our physical experiences, our traumas, our joys. Everything is stored in our body, not only in our memories of our mind. And so that when we learn how to connect to our body and start to release some of this stuff, and when we navigate from the body, we are navigating in a completely different way. We are able to process the traumas that weigh us down and keep us so neurotic in our mind. And basically, I just wish these reference points were more easily available to me in my own growing journey. And so I feel a big part of my work is to help bring awareness around this to others that were in that space and help them on this path of healing.
Mm-hmm. Hence the So You Want to Take Psychedelics
exactly.
series. Is that what it's called?
It's called the Psychedelic Orientation Series. So you're thinking of doing psychedelics. You read the Michael Pollan book and your friend's uncle's cousin had the most transformative experience with ayahuasca. And now you think it's your turn. And so, yeah, that's coming. We had the first episode come out on on Lucid News. And I'm currently cooking up the episode of So You're Thinking of Doing Psychedelics Solo. You're thinking of taking your first solo journey. And it's a bit of a can of worms to unpack because there's a lot of disclaimers and precursors to doing this sort of work on your own. I'm a little hesitant to dive in, but I think it's time, and I think a lot of people are doing it. So just because I'm hesitant to put it together doesn't mean, like, I think people are hungry and this sort of information can really help.
Yeah, it would be very valuable, especially now. So tell us about Lucid News, your other baby.
Yay. Lucid News came to be because I organized a psychedelic leadership summit right before Horizons and got to meet a bunch of fabulous people that are all holding some sort of leadership roles in the community, in the various psychedelic communities. And they'd all come out to Horizons. And I met Ken Jordan, who is one of the founders of Evolver and Reality Sandwich. And the two of us have a similar tradition from where we come from in our own personal journey work. And just had a lot to connect on. And we're like, oh yeah, let's go. And we had a bunch of friends. We all went to dinner and him and I kept just talking, and then going to the symposia after party and talking and had all these ideas. And we're like, I think there could be there's a space here for more journalism that's like really focused on covering the business end of things, making a very clear distinction between opinion and journalism. Mm-hmm. covering like the patent issues and, you know, new businesses and spaces that are taking tons of investment from where and like, how is all this unfolding? So, we started cooking it up and he talked to Annie Oak and she joined us, which was such a treat. And he had, Faye, and I can't say her last name right.
Sakalaridis?
Oh, there we go. Sakalaridis, yeah. And
hi, Faye, if you're listening.
Yay. And April Short. And now we have Becky Shuttle. She's been working with us as an intern. And so this is our core team. And we got some investment funding and we seed funding, and we were able to put together this amazing project. And we're kind of like, it's sort of in our proof of concept stage still. Mm-hmm. We quite like don't quite have enough to be as regular as we'd like to be, but we're getting there. So it's really exciting. It's been well received, and I think we're definitely meeting a need within the community, and it's a joyful place to be.
Definitely a huge need to differentiate between opinion and like fact-based journalism. I'm guessing, and from some of our prior conversations, that means that you might have to be going to some conferences and events that you might not normally be at, right? Like you have to report on everything.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. And it's really like treacherous terrain right now, as there's a lot of like newcomers in this space who had a couple of awesome journeys and were like, great, psychedelics are going to change the world. I'm so excited. I can't wait to tell everyone. I'm going to put all my energy into creating the psychedelic conference. And everybody in the psychedelic community is like, no, stop, because they don't know what they're doing. And they're creating platforms for people who aren't qualified necessarily, or, you know, overdosing their clients, or, you know, have histories of sexual abuse or all kinds of things. And, you know, if you're new in the space, you don't even understand what is going on. So, I mean, there should be a criteria of like, hey, if you haven't been in the space for a couple of years and attended X amount of other proper psychedelic conferences, you probably shouldn't be doing your own conference.
Even if you're not new in the space, it takes a lot of awareness to put on an event and a conference. Yeah. And it's something that should be done in a group, for sure.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. When I started doing these little leadership summits, I was so hesitant to do them. I had started them with a core group of people that were all had longer experiences than me, but everybody got super busy. And it was kind of in my lap, and I was like, I think this still wants to happen. And then I had to talk to a few people and be like, am I qualified enough? I still don't know if I'm... And they're like, no, you've been around long enough. You're good. Go ahead. Please do it. Make it happen. It needs to happen. And so it continued to happen. But I definitely like was asking for the blessing of some elders in the space. And yeah, good. I got it.
Will you say a little bit more about... some of your films like The Healing Powers or other, you've also worked on intentional communities, right? You can choose. I want to hear more about some of your film work.
Cool. Yeah. I guess it maybe is best told in the arch of where, like when I first got into, when things in my life started first making sense. I'm wondering how much longer that was after my first or after my like second and third ayahuasca experiences. I think I told you briefly before, ayahuasca wasn't working so well for me. And then in hindsight, like I did it 13, 14, maybe 15 years ago, the first time, and I thought it didn't work. But when in hindsight I look back, I'm like, oh, that's when my severe social anxiety went away. That's amazing. And then I had a couple of journeys, I think in like 2015. And I was like, oh, this isn't working. I was super sick and nauseous, super pain. But actually after that, that's when things started to finally dial in. Like I had been shifting from just directing into shooting films. And so I started actually getting good enough to get real jobs. And so I was starting to shoot documentaries, which is this perfect blend of directing and shooting. And there was a lot more work for somebody who could hold a camera than just the director. Getting a job as a director on its own is pretty damn hard. So going from pretty unemployed and really struggling to finally working in the field to also getting really more serious about my own healing work, I at that point I started discovering other people that were working with psychedelics intentionally near where I lived in Los Angeles. And I realized after a journey, like, holy shit, the world needs to know. And so I started to like do some investigative, whatever, reach out to other producers and be like, hey guys, I have this idea for a documentary series around psychedelics, like Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown, but instead of food, let's do it about psychedelics and share different modalities of psychedelics, different modalities of healing, tell people's healing stories. And everybody was like, dude, there's no fucking way. Like, this is so illegal. There's no way we'll get funding. There's no way we'll get it aired. Not happening.
Wow. So funny that not that long ago, that's what people were saying.
Yeah. That was like 2016 for sure. And then I ended up getting this job where to shoot a documentary in Panama about an intentional community or like an eco-village that was building itself. It was called Kalayala. And not too far from Panama City, not too far from where we are. I wonder, that's probably like 6 hours away or something. And I actually kind of, I was in a little over my head. And, but it was a wonderful, rather than going down the wrong part of that story, you know, it was an incredible introduction to the idea of intentional community and the way it was set up. It was really, a pretty cool system where they brought experts in agriculture and culinary and like design and, you know, permaculture, all these things, and brought in students to like, they would get credit for living there and then learn how to build an eco village, you know, and it's just still incredibly hard to do it. I don't think they totally hit all the beats, but the aspiration was there. And to leave without making any footprint or using resources from outside of where they were.
That's a tall order.
Super, super tall order. Yeah, like they didn't get there. And I wonder where things are at now. But it was a beautiful aspiration. And I also started hearing about other intentional communities. And it really like laid down the seed of like, wow, we could be living in harmony with the earth and still be, you know, still have internet, still have certain, you know, modern technological advances that we want. And so that actually started me on one path of where I then went to India and stayed in Auroville.
I know all about Auroville. Do you know about Sadhana Forest?
I do. Okay, yeah, cool. I went and visited it. They've got some really cool technology of like digging cisterns and say like they totally converted the land there that was like completely barren, mm-hmm. and was able to grow a forest once they just dug holes and caught all the rain from the rainy season.
Yeah, raised the water table like several meters or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, the person who first introduced me to psychedelics was a longtime worker there.
Yay. That's so awesome. Yeah. I spent some time there after my trip to Peru. But anyway, you know, so I burnt myself out on that documentary because I didn't know what I was doing. And I also didn't know how to take care of myself. And so I went to Peru to continue to figure out why ayahuasca wasn't working for me. And I started filming my own journey. And so I was traveling through Facebook.
Aren't we all? Every day.
Way too much. Way too fucking much. I was traveling through Peru. I was doing my own healing work, like working with shamans, sharing my very interesting efforts of having a breakthrough with ayahuasca, which I incidentally did. And a lot of, yeah. I have all this documentary footage for that, too, which, by the way, needs to get turned into a documentary. I can't wait till when it does. This point is just sitting on hard drives. And so I was sharing about it, and my friend, who is an editor-in-chief at Mary Jane, saw my work and saw that I was traveling with all my camera gear and said, hey, we have a series called Cannabis Around the World. I know you're going to India. Will you shoot something about it? And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. And then they were like, you know, actually, we want it to be hosted. Can you do a hosted thing? And it was so funny because the whole time I'd been thinking about my doc series around psychedelics, I didn't know what the thread would be that kept it connected one episode to another, and it never occurred to me to be the host. I was like, oh, I might need a host. I never thought I would be good enough to be a host.
Wow. So you were the connection all along. You didn't know what the connection would be, and it was actually you.
Yeah. I was like talking, when I was at Kalayala, I remember talking to other people that were like kind of host-like, and I was like, oh, do you want to be the host? And they were like, yeah. And then, you know, then I was talking to them and I was like, wait, you don't know anything about psychedelics. You don't understand about anything about healing work. You don't understand about trauma. Like, this would be the blind leading the blind. Like, why would we want to do that? And so, you know, I kept mulling over. And so when Mary Jane was like, hey, would you host? I was like, okay, I think maybe I could. I happened to have a friend who I'd met in Peru who then met me in India and join me. And I found out about these Indian holy men called Agori, and they embrace everything in the world, good and the bad, but especially the bad, because it's easy to embrace the good. All the, from the caste system, the higher ups, the upper caste would always wear all white and everything would be clean and everything would be perfect, and they considered themselves holier than thou, even though we knew they weren't. And so in sort of a backlash response, the Agori holy men embraced everything that was considered bad, immersing themselves in it, rubbing themselves in the ashes of the dead, drinking from the skulls of humans, eating the flesh of the dead when somebody was dead on a funeral pyre. And so I found out about these guys, they also smoke marijuana to connect to the divine. And I was like, ooh, this is the most amazing story ever. Let's find an Agori. And it just so happened that like 2 or 3 hours north of where we were was the Magh Mela, this massive festival that happens every year. But like every 12 years, it brings in 150 million or something like insane. It brings in more people than anywhere in the world. It's the hugest Hindu festival, and it's a Hindu festival. It's really something special. And so my friend and I got to go to a smaller version of it, which was still beyond massive, and find an Agori, which was a whole hunt. And we had to like ask people, like, hey, do you know if there's any Agori? You know, and people are like, no Agori is here. And we were like pointing us, and everywhere we went with the camera and the fact that we were not Indian, like, just drew huge crowds because people weren't used to seeing foreigners here. And so it was really like wild. So that got to be our first episode, and I didn't really know what I was doing, but we figured it out. I had terrible food poisoning, but I hosted an episode, and it ended up doing really well and going viral.
Ayahuasca was preparing you for that. It was like, this is what it's going to be like when you go on and do more work.
Right, exactly.
So you can do it.
You can sit up when you're like dying of food poisoning. You can hold your head up straight. In the ayahuasca, luckily, I was able to curl up in a ball. But yeah, it totally prepared me. That's funny. And so from there, after I went back home, Mary Jane was like, well, what else you got? That was kind of cool. What else you got? And I was like, I have this series around psychedelics. It's called The Healing Powers of Psychedelics and Other Mindful Practices. We're going to celebrate all the different ways of healing. We're going to change what healing is, like redefine that and like show that, because, you know, I feel like the traumas we encounter in our life are like a piece of a puzzle that our souls chose to help us unpack who we are. And it's once that we overcome that trauma that we get to learn who we, like, our true power and our true magnificence. But I don't think without encountering a difficulty, an obstacle, do we have the incentive to grow and expand? So, so with that series, but I was still full on dealing with so many of my own traumas and still my own programs, and then probably still am now, who knows? It's like you're never done with this. But I created eventually what ended up being 8 episodes, and traveling a bit around the world, having a lot of really interesting journeys, funding most of that myself, doing it by the skin of my teeth, like barely able to scrape and make the ends meet, but we got this thing together, and I thought it totally crashed. I thought it didn't go anywhere, but it ended up getting picked up by Gaia TV. And so now it's available there. It got on earlier this year in February. So super, super delighted. I'm so glad to share it. And simultaneously, I think I mentioned Oroville, I ended up connecting also with Domenhor, which is this magical intentional community in northern Italy, where they dug a series of temples into the sides of the Alps in total secrecy over the course of 15 years to help humanity survive. It's a really interesting, magical, mythical story that is a whole podcast unto itself. Yeah. But I'm a huge fan of really like the inquiry of how can humanity live in balance in the world? Like how can we platform these stories and hear them more and more so that that can become an inquiry or like a pursuit that more and more people do. We just need to see it more. Yeah.
Hmm. And so, what are some of the ways that you're trying to help people see it more now? What's your mission?
What's my mission? Let's see. What I've been drawn towards is to create a play. I'm writing a one-woman play that you now have been so incredibly key to helping me do, because you and I, Leah and I, had lots of conversations last night and I told her my whole life story.
She went deep.
I don't think I've ever met such an independent listener, so thank you for helping create that space. And we recorded most of it, and now we have all this where there's these other stories that I totally forgot about and to fill in even blanks. And I'm going to transcribe it all, which is going to really help me because it needs to get out. So I feel I have a pet theory that I like to share as far as what my mission is. I've had a few psilocybin journeys, especially. They're really powerful in creating mystical experiences. And I think there's actually research now coming out that psilocybin, a certain amount, will definitively create a mystical experience. And I've gone over that edge a couple times. I did an episode on psilocybin. It's mushrooms with an M-A-O-I. Makes the mushrooms four times more powerful. And I've met God twice. God being the creative energetic force that drives the universe, genderless, all-knowing, all-powerful, omnipotent, omniscient. But, you know, I always think, like, in these early inquiries that I had as a kid in church, going, like, why are we going to hell if we steal to feed our families? And what is hell anyway? Like, are you just constantly on fire? And at some point, don't you get numb? Or if you're in eternal bliss, what is heaven? Isn't that get boring? Like, where are you going to go when you're everywhere? How are you going to grow if you're perfect? What are you going to do? It must get kind of boring to be in constant bliss. So what would you do? But, you know, and this is Alan Watts and Hinduism and lots of other, especially Eastern philosophies, but what do you do but create a game and take parts of yourself and create Earth and parts of yourself and create humans and who knows, maybe aliens and all other things. And I think animals and plants and everything that is alive or not even alive. I think you create life and then take all the humans and get all the humans' amnesia and say, okay, parts of me, let's play a game of forgetting what it's like to be all-knowing and all-powerful and omnipotent and omniscient. And so I think humans are parts of God playing that game. And what I have been instructed in my very interesting journey is that I thought the one specifically was where God and I say it so casually, but again, just that creative, energetic force without any of the dogma from the churches. God goes, are you willing to accept your mission? And the mission in my mind was to pull back the curtain to help people remember that they're part of God, to remember that they're part of the divine, to stop condemning themselves for all their mistakes, to stop hating themselves for not being perfect, to like shift the world we live in, you know, and so to help people understand these big things. And so, you know, again, pulling back this curtain of separation is the way I saw it in my mind's eye. Are you willing to help do this work? And I was like, wow, it's going to be a lot of sacrifice, isn't it? It's going to be really hard. And I'm sitting there thinking myself as a little old lady struggling and it being so hard. Me killing myself to help get the word out. And that God energy was like, yes. And I was like sitting there crying. Okay, but I'm so honored that you asked. Like, wow, this is so cool. Okay, it's hard, but this is an important mission, so I accept. And I sit back and I relax and I like sit and I think and I'm like, wait a minute. And by the way, right before this inquiry, I'd just gotten a tour of the universe of all the elaborate levels and dimensions and wild hallucinations, or not hallucinations, wild visions of everything that there is. So much, right? So much abundance. And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm like, wait a minute, okay, God, you just show me all this amazing stuff. You just show me so much abundance. Why do I have to, like, do this work in scarcity? Like, why can't I do this work in abundance? Like, can I have a big family and friends, and can this be joy, and can this be amazing work? Like, this is amazing, important, holy work. It should be done in joy. And God was like, yes. I was like, aha. You know, and there's some insight. It's like our perception of what God is so much through the frame that we've been taught. And my old frame has been so much scarcity and so much struggle and so much strife. And that's the way I thought I had to do things. And when I did things like that, it was hard. And I was killing myself. And I can choose to do things with abundance. And so, I mean, that almost goes back to what is this question of what is consciousness now for me? It's like, how do we do it with that abundance, right? I think I just went down a couple different tangents, and I'm trying to remember what the main question was. Films? Oh, mission.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, so not too far. So, yeah, I just want to create content to help people remember that they're parts of God. We're parts of God all playing a game. This can be a game if I think collectively humanity has to rise up and help each other, help everybody who's not there. I've seen, like, I've gotten into so many deep, dark holes, wormholes of scarcity where I can't see my way out. I cannot see my way out. And there was just there's nothing I could do. It's like banging my head against a wall so many times. And luckily, on my path, there were enough people that were able eventually, and it took forever. There was so long where I was like, why doesn't anyone help me? Why can't I find a mentor? Why can't I find a teacher? Couldn't find anything. But finally a piece came in, and then eventually later another piece came in, and people started to support and say, I like what you're doing, and I believe in you. Even though I didn't believe in myself, but enough people started saying, I believe in you. I had one coworker who I worked with on the boat who was like, you're gonna do some big stuff, kid. I really believe in you. And like, hearing that was so powerful, because it was like things like that and a couple of other random. I did have a moment epiphany when I was like 9 that like I was going to do things that were going to really matter in the world. And so like these little hints have happened, and they just kind of kept it going. So I really want to help help others on that same path. Be part of those hits and helps to see, like, I believe in you, and I believe in all of us, right? We all have the capacity. We just need to support each other more.
And you mentioned in an earlier conversation that psychedelics are being sort of birthed into this new world, or like rebirthed, because it's not like they're new. But yeah, you said that you see yourself playing a role in the net of that.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what, like, Lucid News is doing, you know, helping create some sense of accountability. I think the psychedelic leadership summits that I've been organizing for the last couple of years are a part of just getting people to know each other. I think as we know each other, as we come to this more now in a spirit of joy and camaraderie, like, I've actually shifted these little gatherings we've had away from problem solving, the heavy issues in the community, to connection. To let's like build the foundation of getting to know each other one-on-one, eye gazing, let's share some vulnerable truths, and let's play a little bit. And then from there, you know, the relationships are built. And I think that simultaneously, I'm very interested in creating spaces for mediated discussion for the other steps. But I think to start without people really knowing each other, and to start without a place of play, is we're missing the point a little bit. Psychedelics teach us, like, let's have some fun while we are doing some very serious work. So this is now a part of, yeah, and regarding that net, I think as we all kind of come online and we all connect with each other and we all get to know each other and we become friends, we become like we're a connected network. I see this almost like birthing canal, I think, that we each make nodes of and connected, and we can help psychedelics come online into the mainstream with a shared sense of ownership, a shared sense of accountability, and a shared sense of joy and fun. So, yeah.
Speaking of fun, I hear that you want to make some Sphinx Gate happen at Burning Man. What's that about?
Yes! Yay! What a great segue. Yeah, the Sphinx Gate at Burning Man. So coming from so much struggle and hardship, and then like being at Burning Man always felt really important, I think, because you just see this is the exploration of what is possible when we come to places from joy, when we allow the imagination to unfold without limitations. I mean, of course there's limitations, but what does a city look like when you take money out of the mix? What does a city look like when you take commerce out of the mix? You know, and how do interactions change? And this just really opens a whole new vein of inquiry into how we interface day to day in the default reality.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how another guest on this show said to me once that psychedelics are like the back door into the house, and that you can get there, you know, you can get there through the front door with meditation and, you know, like really dedicated practices, and psychedelics are like pretty low investment to get there. You can just take them, even though it's a risky investment, because you may not get into that house, or, you know, where you find yourself in that house might not be very pretty or pleasurable at the time. Nonetheless, it's funny because you were saying creating a community, creating a city without money or without commerce. I'm like, but it's not without money. There's so much money invested in it. There's so much CO2 released into the atmosphere from it.
No, I'm totally.
But it's like, I wonder if psychedelics are to enlightenment as Burning Man is to
systematic change.
Maybe. Yeah. Or just conscious systemic. Yeah. And conscious community.
I think that's a really cool analogy. I like that. Yeah, you know, it's actually perfect. It's just like I describe psychedelics like to those people who really don't know. Somebody actually put a post. I think it was Kevin Matthews. He put a post and he's like, "How would you explain psychedelics to kids?" And I was like, I would stand above them and I'd say, "Look at how you're seeing me now. I'm really big and I'm above you." And then I'd get below them and I'd say, "Look at how you see me now and I look different and you know, and how my voice sounds different, you know," and I would just go around this kid and show them how perspective changes impressions and how psychedelics are tools to change your perspective, to give you an idea that there's different possibilities and that you can't see because you're so used to seeing things from a certain, if you're a short person, you're used to looking up at everything. And so, you know, psychedelics, the other way I describe them is like they're a pair of glasses that like the glasses are the social conditioning. And when you remove the social conditioning, you can see the world a lot more neutral than what it is with the social conditioning. I mean, that's a common thing that I occur in my journeys. And so I think what Burning Man does, it's not like a neutral world or like, you know, a truth or anything, but it is a very altered perspective that I think is really helpful for us for creating a new orientation point when we look at our default world. And I think intentional community is similarly, you know, it's like, for me, it's like, you know, there's a lot of problems in cities, default cities that just unfold. There's a lot of the lack of intentionality, for example, or the lack of whatever, there's countless, you can just go on forever with the problems of regular cities. And so, but if you don't go into an intentional community or you don't go to Burning Man, how do you even know that there's another option? And so this is why Burning Man for me feels so important, despite the fact that it does use, it's insane how much resources are poured into it and the CO2 footprint. And however, being in the midst of it during that week, you are given this new place to pivot from and to create from. And again, it comes back to the question of how do we address and orient our lives not from aversion, fear, scarcity, or need, but from desire, joy, inspiration, you know? And it's very possible, but you need to see it. I think you need to somehow have a reference point for it. And so this is why Burning Man is so very important. My first burn was in 1999. The tickets were $69 and it was super anarchistic. Like there was one camp where they were just burning mattresses and shooting guns and just like chaos, you know? And it was like super punk rock. And a lot, it was also like nihilistic. It wasn't, now it's like there's a lot more hopefulness and a lot more, positivity.
I will say being in a place absent of advertising for a week had a really good impact on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really unbelievable.
Yeah. And yeah. Good. I didn't know you've gone. Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Have you gone a few times?
No, I've only been to the Big Burn once, but I've been to a few regional burns. Firefly in Boston.
Yay. Yeah. I've heard good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like 1,000 people in the woods. It's good.
I've never been to any regionals.
You should definitely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so the Sphinx Gate.
Sphinx Gate. Okay, so there's something really, I think, it feels like an act of rebellion to create something so, like we want to create, so really quick to come back to that in a minute. In the film, the 80s fantasy film, The Neverending Story, there are two gigantic sphinxes that one of the heroes of her story needs to cross through to help save the world of Fantasia. And only those who are operating from a pure heart are able to pass through. And those who don't know who they truly are operating from fear and doubt. I think from the aversion and the scarcity and all the things we've just been like talking about, those that are operating from that space have forgotten their true connection to the divinity, forgotten that they're parts of the divine. This is all the game. And anyway, so that's more my interpretation. We've thought about this a lot, clearly. But basically, the hero he wants to pass, and the two sphinxes that are like towering six stories up into the sky, they can see into his heart, and he's so afraid because nobody's passed for like hundreds of years, and he gets doubtful for a moment. So the sphinxes do open their eyes, but they don't get him. They shoot laser beams, but they just miss, and he makes it through. So his heart is just barely pure enough.
Will your Sphinx gate shoot laser beams?
It will absolutely. We're trying to figure that out, though. We're really like, I hope somebody listening to this gets super stoked.
And Dr. Evil.
Yeah. It's like we need a laser beam specialist because also lasers right now are not, there's very few lasers that are allowed to be a Burning Man because somebody lost some vision because lasers are very strong. But I'm wondering, like, I mean, this was also a few years ago, and I bet you that lasers have been developed that don't burn people's eyes out. So let's figure out. I need to find the most innovative laser technologist human being and bring them onto our team, because this isn't like, now we have this amazing team that I'm just beyond delighted on Anael Bonasort. And Perception, I don't even think she goes by her last name. But amazing burners, artists, magic folks that are like building this. And I've never worked on a project that has just had people fly to it like magnets, that are just, everybody's super excited. And the vision of like walking through these like 6 foot, or I think it might be more like 5 feet, five story tall sphinxes with their lasers. And walking through the middle of that.
With a pure heart.
With a pure heart. Fuck yeah. Actually, and the thing is, we're like also wanting to shift the story a little bit. It might be that the lasers are not going to punish you for not having a pure heart. Because fuck punishment paradigm, right?
Right. That would just not make sense in your story to have that.
Exactly. So I think what the idea is to shift it. And the laser beams will actually get you if you are a pure of heart and ready to ascend to the next level. Yeah. So it's a tool of ascension. And we're also thinking of like if maybe there's a control panel in the back where somebody can climb in if they can find it, and then they can operate it with each other and play the sound effects and like, you know, play God to each other basically.
Wow.
It feels a little frivolous. I do struggle a little bit with the part of like, you know, it's going to cost $250,000 or something. It's going to be massive. However, you know, I think we're resourcing all of our wood from the artist on Isle. He works in Hollywood, so he has access to all the prop shops, and they just throw out tons of wood. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be, 70% of that is going to be sourced from that. And whatever wood that we need to get that needs to be fresh or new, we're offsetting that, planting trees out here in Costa Rica. And so we have plans to balance things out. And at the same time, there is something extremely important, and I almost feel like noble, about creating from a space of joy, not from a need or from a scarcity, but for the fucking pure joy of it. And this thing lights me up like nothing has in my entire life. I am so thrilled about it, and as is our team. So, and we're in the middle of quarantine. And who knows whether, like, Burning Man as an org, you know, like, are we going to survive all of this? Of course we're going to survive, but to what degree and how long will it take for Burning Man to happen again? Will it happen in the Black Rock Desert? Who knows? Big questions, but we actually all said, like, even if it doesn't happen in the Black Rock Desert, we're going to bring these sphinxes somewhere. Maybe they'll be their own thing, you know? Mm-hmm. But it will happen. And I think we're going to try to time it. And it feels like, you know, we haven't even got into quarantine, but I'm kind of curious, or not quarantine, but the virus. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on what the virus means, if I can turn the tables on you a little bit.
We're actually running out of time.
Are we?
We are, but what do I think the virus is?
Or like, yeah, in the greater scope of humanity, like...
It's the first of a lot of pandemics that we'll live to see, that some of us will live to see, in my predictions. I think that on a personal level, it's an invitation to like I was saying earlier, like to be with one's mind without having my job to blame, that that's why I'm stressed, or all of my social obligations or whatever, because those have been taken out of the equation and I still feel so much neurosis. So it's, on a personal level, an opportunity to weed out some of the illusion about why I don't feel good sometimes. Yeah. And then on a global scale, I think, just with the greatest rates of infection being in the meatpacking industry, and I know there are different conspiracies and conjectures about where the virus originated, but through the story that it came from a market in Wuhan, just being more conscientious about how we source our food and like where it's coming from, the conditions that the animals are raised in, maybe moving more and more away from animal agriculture, at least from factory farming of animals and plants. It's highly destructive. So there's opportunity there for like rethinking the way things are done, the way CO2 levels have fallen. I think it can, it has showed us that the world can still go on, and we don't have to have such a huge carbon footprint, that we can meet a lot of our needs locally and adapt. And the need for mutual aid is, it's like, I think a lot of people have been helping out in their communities and helping out, the movement for Black Lives, like with the protests going on. And so to have people home and able to be more present and bear witness to that is a beneficial thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think ayahuasca can cure coronavirus. Someone said that to me the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, it's cool. I'm not worried. I'm drinking ayahuasca.
Can you even get coronavirus in an ayahuasca ceremony? It just seems counter opposite. Yeah. That's what I'll say on it for now, though. But I am speaking on a panel about safety in psychedelic therapy during coronavirus and after, so I'm going to be researching it more.
Cool. Good. I look forward to that panel.
So the last question I'll ask you is, what is your consciousness hack these days, or what have you been doing to tap into your consciousness now in this present state of things? What would you share?
Probably a couple of things. It just comes back to coming back to the body. I have a Kundalini practice. I'm a teacher. We did a class today, which was so great.
So great.
And such a joy having somebody to like do it with. I'm so glad it was you. So that's a big part of connecting. So I'm just meditating. What I think is so cool about Kundalini is you first move your body a bunch, which then gets you into your body, out of your monkey mind. You're using your breath, so it's breath. Today's class especially very breath work oriented. Yeah. So shifts again the mind chemistry and gets you fully into your body, and then from that space you can feel your feelings, you can release your feelings, you can process your feelings.
Even without thinking about them, I will say.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think continually, it's with Kundalini, that's one technique. Another technique, I just picked up the guitar like a month ago, and what I've found is that I'm able to get fully absorbed in the practice of it and playing it. And I have I lost an hour the other day and it was so great. I used to have such a hard time. I used to be so hungry to be fully engaged in things, and it was very little that would fully engage me. And now I'm finally after I think I've learned how to resource myself better, now I can engage myself with my guitar and I can engage myself with my drawing. And so I'm finding these practices that get me in my body, out of my neurotic mind into a flow state, and psychedelics. So psychedelic practice, I think, once every couple of weeks now, because I think contrary to what we've been taught, drugs might actually be good for you if done not as escapist, but very intentionally. And I've been, by the way, don't try this at home, kids, unless you are really actually, unless you feel confident you know what you're doing. You've done a lot of research, but they are just incredible tools for self-inquiry and for cleaning and cleaning my own system and releasing trauma that's held in my body. So I'm kind of exploring that path and learning more and more how they work.
Yeah, and taking off the glasses.
Taking off the glasses, social conditioning as much as possible. And then and then deciding on what the glasses are, creating my own frameworks and operating from there, which is just coming no longer from a reactive place, but from a chosen response place. Mm. fun stuff.
So where can people find you to follow you and your work?
Best place is probably, you can see my work on thehealingpowers.com or Lucid News. Lucid News is the news website. And then also probably following me on Instagram. I think it's Marisa_Sturz, MareesaSturz. And I'm on Facebook. We have The Healing Powers and Lucid News there too.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. What a joyful conversation. I can't wait to flip the tables on you. I need to do a podcast, I think. Yeah.
All right. You can, yeah. I'd be happy to be your guest sometime.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com.